All right, if you can all hear and see me fine, just maybe throw up a yes in the chat so we know everything's good. There will be not only my voice, but a couple of video clips in, you know, a couple of the slides. So I just want to make sure that if there's at any point you can't hear anything for some reason, just let me know. And I am so excited to present this morning. This is just one of many presentations that are an absolute obsession of mine because I love the ancient world and more I love all of history actually, but the pre-flood world is fascinating. The giant things in the fossil record, why were they that way? I basically spent the last 15, 20 years studying this in my free time and just love the subject. So you're just gonna get the chance to see some of the fun things that we have been, you know, studying for a while. So the question that Lost World Museum is asking, you've probably heard John say this before online, is it apes, aliens, or Adam? You know, at some point you're in your life, whether you're really consciously doing it or not, you really are answering that question. And so we think that as you look through some of these topics, it kind of helps you to decide one way or another, which worldview you come from. So that this is part three, world history, part three, the pre-flood world. What was that strange world like? I mean, you see everything from weird dinosaurs to giant things. It was crazy. Why was it so strange? I mean, dinosaurs, was there really a god? Well, we're gonna look at everything. The environment, animals, people. Ultimately, we're gonna get into the forces of the flood and stuff like that. The first 1,000 years afterward, underwater cities, the ice age, all that stuff will be in upcoming presentations. This morning, we're gonna kind of flesh out, you know, the plants and animals and the things that contributed to a giant world. So, at this point, after 6,000 years of getting dumber, shorter, and uglier, basically 6,000 years of sin, we still have things that are really beautiful. But how do we know what it was like 6,000 years ago? I mean, other than a few fossils, what can you really piece together about that world? Well, there's actually quite a bit you can piece together. So number one is we lost a lot. I mean, the Earth is one massive graveyard, and there's places in the fossil record where things are just so dense. I'm just gonna show you, you can see this, right? Let me turn it sideways so you can see it better. There's places in the fossil record where, I mean, this is only a few of the Orthoceras, but there's places where clamshells or trilobites or all, you know, different kinds of fossils are thrown together where they're just packed together so tightly. And this just happens to be one of my favorites. I just actually got this in an airport, believe it or not, for $30. I thought that was a really good price. Cool stuff. But you can't really go from one backyard to another backyard without finding a rock with fossil. I mean, they're just everywhere. And I think the most intriguing or difficult thing for most evolutionists, and I'm not trying to be antagonistic, but I think the evolutionists really need to come up with a plausible, realistic explanation for the mass fossil graveyards. This is where there's parts of the world where there's just a ridiculous amount of fossils together, like the Karoo supergroup. This is a mass graveyard where the Encyclopedia of Evolution estimates there's 800 billion fossils. Okay, just let that roll around in your brain for a minute. 800 billion with a B. How do you get that many fossils in one area? Is there anywhere on the planet where even one fossil is consistently being created? You know, it's places like this that stretch the credibility of, you know, even long periods of time to make things like this happen. So, you know, I don't want to get sidetracked because the point really is we lost a lot. But as we go through these things, I really think it's important to ask where we got. Just put this up a little bit. Where we're able to get a mechanism to create some of these things. So let's go on to the next one here. So again, some of the fossils are just in unimaginable numbers. And I love this quote by Dr. Levi Setti. He described one species of trilobite alone as, quote, staggering numbers are taken from the Anti-Atlas Mountains of Morocco. Fred Westman relates that a huge potash mine in Morocco produces so many trilobites that children from the villages ride 50-mile conveyor belts collecting them to sell to foreign dealers. and in the Sahara in unimaginable numbers. We're talking a lot of death, a lot of things that were alive and are now fossilized that aren't being fossilized today. So again, how did we get that many things to die all at once, and they have to be covered so that they don't deteriorate? Now, I mean, this is a hard-shelled animal, but a lot of the fossils were soft, you know, things that would deteriorate. If you have something beside the road, roadkill, you know, that something gets hit, it either gets eaten by, you know, carrion birds of some sort, or it deteriorates, rots, you know, the flies and maggots eat those types of things. Things that die in the woods, like say a tree or whatever, they might get destroyed by mushrooms and the fungi, the different things that are designed to deteriorate those things. But in a fossil situation, you had to have everything covered by mud and water quickly so that it's fossilized. So whether it's trilobites or ammonites, there's just, you know, again, places in the world where there's just boatloads of these things. Now, if you look at the history of animal species and extinction, they're going to talk about these five, sometimes they'll say six major extinction events. And what I'm going to say as a creationist, because again, this is the evolutionary view here in front of you. And then I'm going to say as a creationist, these are just different parts of the year-long flood. There were massive earthquakes and tsunamis, waves of epic proportions. And I could go into detail in a different presentation on that how much, you know, dirt and sediment was deposited in certain areas. But for right now, let's just leave it that there was different points of the flood where we saw a significant amount of death all at once. And one of them is called the, right in the middle there, where it says 90 to 96% of all species was lost. Let me go on to a few more and I'll explain this a little better. It's called the Permian-Triassic extinction event. And it's called literally the mother of all extinctions, because 96%, listen to these numbers, 96% of all marine species died. 70% of all terrestrial vertebrate species died. It was the only known mass extinction of insects. So some 57% of all families and 83% of all genera, I believe they pronounce it, became extinct. So you're talking about epic worldwide death. How do you accomplish, what mechanism allows for that level of destruction? And again, I think they kind of skirt some of these things without really digging in and pulling it apart and saying, okay, how am I going to kill that many things all at once? Especially, for example, like the insects. So insects, they fly. I mean, they can get away fairly easily. Like you can squash one or something, but how do you cover a bunch of insects, especially to the point where you've got a mass extinction of them? Again, that type of thing, I think, is a little bit troublesome for evolutionists, but easily explainable for a creationist, because that worldwide flood, we had everything from, and again, I'll go into this in other presentations, but you had meteors hitting the earth, then they were huge. You had the crust breaking apart. So earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamis, you know what the tsunami in Sumatra in 2000, was it 4 or 6? You know, there's different examples where we see just mass death from waves. So let's go on. Fossil insects, these are just a couple of examples. It's really quite amazing that, again, you have some kind of thing that was able to cover these with dirt and water. But we didn't lose just a few different types of frogs or rabbits. We lost entirely different types of plants and animals. The world was immensely more diverse and amazing. This is a stunning sea lily fossil. It's called a crinoid. It's from Holzmaden shale in Germany, and it boasts some of that particular area in Germany has some of the best preserved fossil ever documented. Really quite amazing. And the size and quality is exceedingly rare. This one, this crown of this thing is 20.8 inches across, and this shale measures 5.48 feet high. And there's even some pyrite on the outer edges of it. So again, we have both plants and animals that we just don't have anymore, and they're strange and odd. So number one thing that we can know about the pre-flood world is we lost a lot, just a lot of things. All right, so, well, we've talked about animals some in the, actually in the last presentation we did, but what else can we know, you know, in, other than that we lost a lot of quantity and variety? Well, number two, the thing that we can know about the pre-flood world, it was lush. Well, how do we know that? How can you piece that together? Well, there's a number of fun reasons. I'm going to start with the giant animals that would need a lot of plants to survive. The Argentinosaurus, 98 feet long, 70 tons, they estimate 65 to 75 tons, 50 foot necks. I love this one scientist, he said that they were really stupidly, absurdly oversized. In our feeble modern world, we're used to thinking of elephants as big, but sauropods reach 10 times the size elephants do. They were the size of walking whales. I love that. That was Michael Taylor, a vertebrate paleontologist from the University of Bristol in England. Do you know how much 70 tons is? That's 140,000 pounds. And some actually say that they got up to 115 feet instead of, they range. They're really not able to totally guesstimate from the bones that are left how big they were, but they do a pretty good job of you know, estimating. So how much does an animal eat that weighs more than 3 Greyhound buses? How do you feed something like that? So sauropod diet. We know that elephants spend 80% of the time eating. An animal that is 10 times bigger than an elephant would probably need 100,000 calories a day, they estimate. So it basically would have to eat as much as it could, as fast as it could, all day, every day. So American Museum of Natural History, if anybody has ever comes across this, I have tried to get a picture of this. They had a cube of 1,000 pounds of foliage that, you know, to show what it would look like in their museum. And apparently it's not on display right now. So if anybody comes across that or has a picture of it, I would love to see that. They said it showed the staggering amount required daily to eat, to feed an animal that big. And interestingly enough, they didn't have jaws or teeth. They didn't chew, like the modern Galapagos Islands, they just swallowed and then it got digested later on. Anyway, very fascinating. I'm going to just to give you, again, an idea of the size of the animals that this environment would have to support. Let me just show you this.
From the bones that were found, we've calculated that Argentinosaurus was a colossal 35 meters long and weighed as much as 75 tons. When born, the hatchlings themselves weigh a paltry 5 kilograms and need to fend for themselves immediately. From studying the embryos and looking at the bones of the adults, we know that the growth of these giants was phenomenal. Over 40 years, they grow from 5 kilograms to an astonishing 75,000 kilograms. At their peak, it's been calculated they grow up to 40 kilograms every day.
Okay. So in case you couldn't hear that quite well, that was as loud as I could get it. Let me know, by the way, how the volume of that was. They did say at one point that they can grow as much as 40 kilograms a day, which would be 88 pounds. Can you imagine putting on 88 pounds in one day? I mean, that's like freaky. How do you feed an animal with needs that much? Well, again, we're trying to explore the idea of how lush the pre-flood world was. A, would have to support animals like this. And another way we know it was lush is because there's massive amounts of coal. There seems, you know, 80, 100 or more feet thick. This is an 80-foot thick coal seam in Decker, Montana. And this is one of the haul trucks, 50 feet tall and can carry up to 250 tons of coal. This is just one truckload. The fact that we even need trucks that big says something about how much coal there is. This is, by the way, a friend of mine in front of the one that she drove. Can you see her? She's that little tiny thing way down. Of course, the wheels are way bigger than she is. And then check this out. Check the car out and the person standing there. This is a coal seam. So since coal, oil, and natural gas are fossil fuels, all this represents a staggering amount of dead plants and animals. So no evolutionary model, in my opinion, really makes sense to produce that much except through cataclysmic upheaval. No river or local flooding. They always talk about, oh, there was a local flood here or a local flood there, or this river overflowed its banks. I'm thinking, okay, so we got, oops, there's one animal and died and buried. Okay, good. We got one covered up. Okay, we need just about a billion or trillion more to make a coal seam this thick. Now notice there's no dirt this isn't layered with dirts. And I can show you, you know, examples where there's layers of coal or fossils and then dirt, coals and fossils, dirt. This is just coal. So this isn't like, okay, we had a little local flood and we got maybe 5-10, let's just say we got 100 animals covered up right here on the lowest level. You still got a freak number of animals you'd have to cover up, and there's no dirt between these. It's all one layer of coal. So this to me doesn't represent massive amounts of time, because you'd have dirt blowing in and rain, you know, moving sediment from here to there. This represents not massive time, but massive amount of death all in one fell swoop. And just again, to give you an idea, the things that you find in the fossil record, this, for example, is a fossil fish that's twisted. I've got another interesting one that looks more like a snake, but it's kind of like an eel. I don't know if you can see both of those pretty good. Fish are good swimmers. They can get away quickly, you know, because you maybe tried to grab one before as a kid. They swim easily and quickly away from danger. But to have it not only buried quickly enough so that it was fossilized rather than deteriorating, excuse me, but rather it was buried so quick it was twisted, this is the type of thing that you see in the fossil record. So again, I think there's just a lot of reasons to believe that what we see is mass death worldwide quickly and all at once and not over a large period of time. So there's so many places throughout the world that there's coal. I mean, absurd numbers or amounts of it. One evolutionist was debating a creationist once and said, you'd have to have long periods of time. There's not enough plant or animal matter to produce so much coal and oil if the earth were just drowned right now. Let's just flood the entire earth. There's just not enough. Well, she's not thinking about what the earth might have looked like before. She's looking at the earth as it is now. For example, before the fountains of the deep were broken up, the majority of the earth was land. They say only 3% is now habitable. And when I first heard that stat, I didn't believe it. I thought, no, it's not. Then I started looking at how much of the earth is water, how much of the earth is land, and of that land that is actually habitable, or I should say that, you know, growth of plants enough to support a good amount of animal diversity versus it being a desert or tundra or just ice and snow. You've got a different earth than we had previous. And in the pre-flood world, before the fountains of the deep were broken up, which is how the Bible describes it, I would say that the earth was mostly land, some obviously, you know, big bodies of water, you know, but they were basically large seas. The Bible says the earth was made to be inhabited in Isaiah 45:18. Do we see that? Do we see evidence of a world in the past that was way more lush, way more inhabitable than it is now? And I would say definitely. So here's the Loyang Mine. And it's another example of where all this lush plant animal matter ended up. In their brochure, the Loyang Power brochure stated that the mine had an annual output of approximately 30 million tons Okay, this is 30 million tons of coal per year. And the seams are up to 170 meters thick, which is 557 feet. So they would use four huge electric powered bucket wheel dredgers. They're used to like excavate the mine. And the largest of these machines is 50 meters high, which is 164 feet high and 190 meters long, 623 feet long. So more than twice the length of a jumbo jet. These machines can dig 4,000 tons, which is 8 million pounds of coal an hour, or 2,000 pounds per second. And in case you don't know what that looks like, I will give you an example. And again, the very fact that we need machines like this to process the sheer amount of coal available tells you something about how much there is of it. And again, therefore, how lush the pre-flood world was. And we're not going to really delve into the oil, but oil and natural gas are decomposed remains of like plants and organisms, including phytoplankton and zooplankton that settled at the bottom of seas or lakes. They're buried under heavy levels of sediment. And then again, the heat and the pressure chemically alters it. But basically, one scientist said that we've probably used about at least 135 billion barrels of oil since 1870. But combine oil, coal and oil and natural gas, and you've got some kind of event that created massive, massive amounts of stuff. Number three, things that we can, again, try to flesh out that pre-flood world, what the ancient world was like. Well, there was a different level of oxygen and pressure. So every time you breathe, or breathed, I should say, in the pre-flood world, you got 50% more oxygen than you do today. So in amber, sometimes you'll find a bubble like that. And what they did, the USGS, they did, it was over 300 samples, and they tested to find out what the air was, the oxygen levels in it. And they came out with 35% compared to our 21%. And for those of you that are kind of math challenged, I didn't get it at first either. I'm thinking 21% now, and it was 35% before. How does that get 50% more? Well, it's half again as much basically. So you have 35%, which is a total of 50% more oxygen in the past than we do today. So amber is fossilized from the sap of trees being buried. Now, bugs normally easily outrun sap. Sap doesn't move very fast, in case you haven't noticed, you know, it on a tree recently. But to see so many bugs and so many different kinds of things trapped in amber, and sometimes to actually even see water with air bubble in it. Let me show you this first. Okay, so again and again, you'll read things like, wow, this is exceedingly rare. You'll see them say this about so many different things. Well, stop and look at this. Again, how often is amber fossilizing today? What would it take for a very stationary, very slow-moving piece of amber to cover a bug, much less encapsulate water with an air bubble? This screams catastrophe. You know, amber or resin being, you know, wiped off trees and just, you know, thrown around in ways that only like a wave or a cataclysmic, you know, trees crashing into each other and things like that. That's what could cause stuff like this. Otherwise, you're just not going to see stuff like this. Let's see here. So, oh, there's my number three, actually. Air pressure and oxygen levels different. This is dragonflies. I want to bring up dragonflies because in the fossil record, we see them much bigger than we do today. We see 26 to 28 inch wingspan. So from wingtip to wingtip, you're talking 28 inches across. Can you imagine one of those landing on your head? The biggest one, by the way, is in a French museum. Now, dragonflies, they don't have like a respiratory system the way we do. They breathe directly through the sides of their body. And if you had one this big, and you couldn't have one today this big because our oxygen and pressure, air pressure levels wouldn't support this kind of thing. It would suffocate. So this is another clue to recreate the pre-flood world, what it was like. Another example that will kind of give you an idea of, again, that there had to have been different air pressure or oxygen levels, things like that. These big birds, you know, birds, pterodactyls, pterosaurs, various things. The question always was for the scientists, how do you get an animal that big to generate enough energy to fly? Because again, your muscles have to produce energy to move a wing. You'd have to have a significant amount of oxygen in order to be able to produce the kind of energy to get an animal this heavy and large off the ground. Well, the Encyclopedia Britannica, I don't know if it still does, but it did in the past, and I kid you not, they suggested that the pterodon would just run down the hill on its stubby little legs and somehow get airborne like that. Well, what's a lot more plausible is the oxygen-rich atmosphere turbocharged the muscles, giving them the kind of oxygen levels they need to be able to fly. It would basically be like turbocharging a race car. So anyway, another clue. Many major athletes regularly spend time in hyperbaric chambers, and if you're not familiar with those, they create a higher pressure level and a higher oxygen level. So what it does is it loads or supersaturates your cell with oxygen so that you heal faster and you regenerate tissue quicker. Wish I had time to get into some of the cool examples of that, but I'll just show you one. Baby Jessica, maybe if you're old enough to remember, in 1987, a 58-hour ordeal began when this 18-month-old, she fell down an 8-inch pipe. Can you imagine getting stuck in that? Her right leg, this horrifies me, her right leg got stuck above her shoulders in this pipe. She had severe but not life-threatening injuries, they said. Gangrene had set into the right foot, and there was a gash on her forehead and back of her head. So a doctor was going to amputate her leg, but another suggested hyperbaric, and within hours they'd restored circulation to her leg, and she only ended up losing a part of her pinky toe. Magnetic field gives you another idea of what was different about the pre-flood world. Our magnetic field was possibly greater, or some aspect of having the Earth shield. Our Earth is shielded from certain types of rays that would be damaging to our skin. And if the magnetic field or some of these other ways we're being shielded were higher, then it would give us an idea of what would allow things to grow bigger. And there's this guy, I wish I could get better pictures, but for some reason, there's not that many pictures of on the internet of what I feel is one of the most fascinating experiments ever done. What they held that in Japan? Is that where they held that?
Yeah, it was the Expo, World Expo.
World Expo, 1985 or six.
Yeah.
And they had a tomato plant so big, they had to have a scaffolding and a ladder to get up to it. It produced ridiculous amounts of tomatoes, and they were, it was, instead of being cherry tomatoes, they were the size of a softball, I think they said. So higher air pressure, magnetic field, various different levels of things, we can experiment today and produce stuff like that. So if you put all those together, what was the pre-flood world capable of doing? Let's just kind of summarize so far. We have way more kinds of animals in the pre-flood world. It was extremely lush. Only 3% of the Earth is inhabited today. Higher oxygen and pressure allowed for bigger growth. We had a higher magnetic field probably, and possibly even a crystalline shield. There's some theories on that, but I don't have time to get into that today. And it may or may not be, you know, something that actually happened or not, but it's plausible. And one more area that I really want to dig into, oh my goodness, no pun intended, is the soil. That's sad. Soil conditions. So this is just a couple in Scotland. They're one of many, many, many people around the world that are have been and still are experimenting. Cameron and Moira Thompson, they took an acidic, infertile area that's exposed to severe weather in Scotland, and they made it yield vegetables, large vegetables, and not the kind that ew, our vegetables got too big, couldn't eat them all. Let's just pawn them off on some of our neighbors or take them to church and hand them out, you know, because they don't taste good. No, these things, even though the onions were size of footballs and strawberries the size of apples, they were delicious and highly nutritious, and they lasted a long time. These guys said the water content of the potatoes was less, so much so that they a year later, they were still eating their potatoes. They were still good condition. So how were they doing that? Well, this is a very important piece of information, because it tells something about what the validity of the Bible, because the Bible talks about post-flood there being giant people still before they died out, and giant plants and animals. There was a cluster of grapes so big and heavy that it was carried on a pole between two men when they went and investigated the Promised Land. So over the first 1,000 years, in pockets, there were still areas where people were living long, they were tall, and they were, the vegetables or fruits were big. So can we see that today? Yes, one of the best resources, if you have any interest in gardening or trying some experiments like this, go to remineralize.org. That's remineralize.org. Look at the bottom left-hand picture. I'm contacting her right now. I'm trying to get permission to get the actual photos from her on this. Well, top left, I should say, is before they added rock dust, or it's basically glacier dust or volcanic rock ground down. They take different rocks and they grind it down and they spread it over like a fertilizer over the soil. And that's before the bougainvillea, before it was remineralized. And then this is afterwards. Unbelievable transformation. And I could give you example after example around the world where they're trying this, and it's absolutely fascinating. We could do a whole presentation just on soil. I threw this in at last minute. I was going to get the name of this guy. I think it was it Cuba or somewhere in South America? I'm not sure. He's using it on his vineyard. And look at the size of those clusters of grapes compared to the the more average size that you see in general. So again, there's tremendous things that we can do. If we want to talk about lowering carbon dioxide levels and you know, stopping the greenhouse effect, they go into great detail about how much more fertile land can be, how much more nutritious the stuff is. And this gives us an idea again how dinosaurs could have, instead of having to eat frantically all day long every day, what plants there were perhaps were more nutritious, and so you didn't have to eat as much in order to get the kind of needs that you had. Just an idea. But anyway, this website goes into a lot of the different factors, and very interesting. I did some giant experiments of my own back in 2006 and 7, and I'm actually going to be doing some more over this next year. This is just a plain old, you know what a kohlrabi looks like? I didn't until I tried to grow giant cabbages, and of the ones I kept, one plant kept looking weirder and weirder, and finally decided the thing wasn't a cabbage. And this one in particular was one kohlrabi, and instead of being a nice round ball, this thing was the size of a pineapple. It was just amazing. This is one of my cabbages that I grew. The head itself was about 14 inches, and then the outer leaves went beyond that. And it tasted great. My biggest sunflower, not too bad. It was, you know, just over 13 feet. My biggest, and I just went online and I bought giant everything. I just giant whatever seed it was, I just bought, you know, a giant version. And I used something called Sonic Bloom. It's like say like a Miracle-Gro on steroids, but you play this music to the plants. I know it sounds a little bizarre, but you play this music and because they found out that the key of D, I think it was, it's basically doing what birds do to nature. Apparently when birds sing, it opens up the pores or the stomatas on the undersides of the leaves. So you'd play this music, it would open up the pores, you'd spray the bottom of the leaves, and then with this Sonic Bloom stuff. And I got a, you know, a fairly decent sized, you know, pumpkin out of it. And the seeds were delicious, by the way. It was absolutely delicious. Best I'd ever had. Giant squash I tried in 2007. And then even the angle of the sun makes a difference. Those little leaves are what I had all winter on a plant. You know, just it's barely able to support, you know, to keep the plant alive. And then the minute we really started to see the sun get to where it was really falling strong with the spring angle of the sun, all of a sudden the plant started growing so much bigger leaves. And you can see there's just a lot of factors that if you took them all together, then it would give you an idea of maybe what the pre-flood world looked like. This is just a guy, he travels all over the world and he apparently loves, he's a botanist, I think you call him. Anyway, he travels all over, look at these cool plants and stuff. And I like his little adventures. This is just one of his giant plants that he saw. But imagine if a plant gets this big now, what it could have been like in the pre-flood world with the right kind of sunlight, protection from, you know, harmful rays, right oxygen, carbon dioxide levels, and the right nutrients in the soil, everything balanced in a perfect condition. Something was supporting giant animals and also creating these lush coal fields and stuff. So again, I think this helps us to understand this. Club mosses today, you find these, I don't know if where else in the world, but in the Northeast, 6 to 12 inches tall. And they come in various forms. Like there's the one on the left is different from the one on the right. Those are two different types of club mosses. In the pre-flood world, we had club moss that is really just enormous. And it grew to the size of trees. So a lot of these plants were like this. The club mosses, they grew 120 to 130 feet, whereas some of the other things I'm going to show you in a second grew to be 90 to 100 feet. But it's just fascinating to see what things were like. This is actually a calamite. Let me show you, because what you're seeing still on the screen is the club moss. And there's a trunk to show you how big the club moss, you know, got, 130 feet. This, what you're seeing right at the moment, is a trunk, basically, to one of these horsetails that you're seeing on the screen now. So some people call them snake grass, horsetails. This is one on the left that's alive today and a fossilized example of it. I got a little plastic white guy, you know, white little plastic thing right there at the bottom, and then a couple of the animals are proportionate to the guy. This would help you understand what the sizing. But for that plant to be appropriate, like if that guy was 6 feet tall, that plant would have to be double at least, you know, than that just to have it representative. So imagine standing at the base of, again, nowadays we look at them and they're, you know, they're maybe this tall, couple feet tall. Imagine looking up at something towering over you like that. Now, in the right conditions, you still can get them big. In South America, they're this place in Chile, they were about 16 feet. There's places where they've been seen to be 24 feet. I actually was talking to somebody last night from Peru, went back and forth with a couple of people. I'm trying to get my hands on my own photos and video footage of this until I can get back down there myself. I can't wait to go back and get pictures of, and videos of some of this. I'm gonna drone it too. So this is a giant tree fern, and I'm not sure if I brought that down here. I don't think so. I'll show it to you next time. So ferns, the size of trees. Now in Melbourne, Australia, we see stuff like this, things that didn't dumb down. They give us an example or an idea of what it'd be like to be, you know, in a world like that. Just kind of, imagine yourself back there at that point. Encyclopedia Britannica said 80 feet, but 60 to 80 feet is roughly what we see. And then, let's see, is this my video clip? Yeah, let me show you a quick video clip. Just imagine something that big. It's amazing. So if you think of other things, maybe something's coming to mind that you would say hadn't dumbed down, a sequoia would be a great example. Sequoias and redwoods. I don't know why some things dumbed down and some didn't. It's hard to say, but you know, some of you maybe even been there and seen this for yourself. There's, you know, two people in the left-hand picture, a close-up, and then in the right-hand picture, way up near the top, you see one of their orange jackets, so you get a glimpse of how big these trees are. Absolutely amazing. But, you know, sequoias weren't the only thing. I'm going to show you some example of old growth in the U.S. before, like, nowadays we cut things down so much, everything's logged so much, you don't see these type of things growing anymore. But this was a 16-foot cedar. 1 to 2 feet wide is how big a spruce normally gets today. But you know, look at these people in the sitting in that. This is a Douglas fir from 1918. Douglas fir from 1899. A cedar stump. Look at them all sitting there on that. 1905. So nowadays you will see tall trees. And again, these are some more of the things that didn't dumb down, and it gives you an idea of what that whole world was like. These are giant Australian eucalyptus trees, and these boys are still big, 425 feet tall they can get. Let's switch over to Thailand. The highest tree today in Thailand, they're about almost 200 feet. But in Thailand, let me show you a fossil they dug up. And it's going to, they're going to pan down the length of this, so you'll get a chance to see how long it is. The longest petrified log currently over there is 200, well, in general, the longest petrified log is in Thailand, is 237 feet long, suggesting the original tree probably was more about 330 feet. And it's closely related to the modern Cupassia elegans, if I'm pronouncing that right. And it's the same family as beans, peas, and locust tree. It's just another example of things that, like, you know, sequoias and redwoods that, you know, some somewhat big today, 200 feet, some obviously a lot higher, 330 before. So what does this all indicate? When you pull everything together, how can I paint a picture? Like, you know, when I try to find something online, when they try to recreate the pre-flood world, you know, of course, as evolutionists, they just say this is Carboniferous period. And though, you know, I don't think anything we can draw really gives us an idea of how lush and amazing this world was. So I'm just going to end with four or five pictures to spark your imagination. I think when you look at all of the amazing beauty, symmetry, iridescence, the math that's built into nature, all the different things that you see in the wild, after 6,000 years of sin or getting dumber, shorter, uglier, de-evolution, I think that it speaks personally of the magnificent power and love of God. Again, how do you get all of these things coming from, you know, nothing through mutations? Because we don't see examples of positive mutations. We see examples of negative mutation. You see things ending up with two heads or five legs or legs sticking out the back. You don't see mutations making things more beautiful. They have a really hard time coming up with examples of positive mutations. They really do some dancing around the answers for that. Whereas look at this, the colors, the amazing way things are. Ultimately, you have to have an answer for where all of this came from. So my answer for me is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But again, the Lost World Museum is all about you exploring all three, apes, aliens, or Adam theory, and coming up with what makes sense to you, we want to provide you with just some ideas to think things through and come up with an answer for yourself. So we think it has eternal consequences, or, you know, it plays itself out in a very important way. All right. Let me stop the recording and then we'll take some questions.